Hi everybody, my name is Chris Deasy, and it was great this week to catch up with Declan Kavanagh. Now, Declan is one of my colleagues at the University of Kent. He's senior lecturer in 18th century studies and based in the School of English. Declan's specialism is in the area of poetry and political pamphlets from the 18th century and how they address questions of masculinity, nationhood, gender, sexuality and disability. We talk about surviving lockdown and how it impacted on Declan personally. And we find out about his research, how he became interested in the study of arrangements of power around gayness, queerness and transness. Declan talks about the rage but never any sense of shame that he felt over his sexuality. And he's not sure that as much ground has been won in recent decades as some people think. There is, for example, still transphobia. And there are questions over whether feminism speaks for trans women. Declan reflects on the toxic and restrictive notions of gender, which are impacting on people, and how, although trans people are everywhere, media representations to this end are not always helpful. We talk about Section 28 and the notion of queerness as being in flux. Declan remembers watching breakfast TV as a child and the Spice Girls being interviewed. We learned that he used to be into heavy metal and the Smiths. And we hear Declan's reaction to me mentioning that Cilla Black supported the Tories. And he gives us his thoughts on cancel culture and why he thinks Morrissey is a racist and how we shouldn't be afraid to call out racism. Declan discusses nostalgia in this context and how it comes from a sense of loss and uncriticality, which is dangerous. The culture wars, says Declan, are about nostalgia, and he recalls people he knows who are stuck in their past. He says he has always been inclined to look towards the future. And then towards the end of the interview, Declan reflects on what it felt like to be four. And we learn about friendships from over the years, how he survived his school days, as well as why he is okay with people misrepresenting him. It was such a pleasure for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews to meet face to face with Declan Kavanagh from the University of Kent. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is a great pleasure to have Declan Kavanagh for my latest nostalgia interview. And actually, it's great, Declan, to do this in person because I've got very used to recording my interviews, as, of course, is the case with my lectures, online over Zoom over the last 18 months. So how has lockdown been for you?
It's been about surviving, I think, for me. So I feel quite proud that I have, you know, braced the three lockdowns, each were quite different, and survived them. But I do also feel like something has been lost. I don't really know how to put it. I think I felt after the second lockdown like I had been in some way irrevocably changed. But I mean, that it sounds dramatic. So my circumstances changed really dramatically anyway before the lockdown, because my husband left. He got a job in Dublin, and he left to take up that job in February 2020. And I drove back with him, and he got settled there, and then I came back on my own. And then it was at that point that the first national lockdown in March was called. So it was like a lot of change and a lot of loss. And I'd gone from living with my partner and our cat in our house that we bought in, you know, Canterbury, together, very happily living there. And then suddenly in this situation where I was living alone with my cat, very thankful for the cat, but ultimately alone and facing out into a world that was in retreat. So I had this real sense of kind of looking in on others, and being quite isolated. And I was left with that, and that was my challenge. How do I deal with this sense of isolation and strangeness and loneliness that was always going to be there in some way because of the big change, but is kind of amplified by this world in retreat.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people found that experience. I mean, for me, I was almost like, it was like a rabbit in the headlights situation. I was coming onto campus until the day that the government called the first lockdown on the 23rd of March, which happened to be my parents' wedding anniversary. So it was like, happy anniversary, but actually we're all retreating. Mm-hmm. And I left work at, say, 5 or 6 that evening, knowing that the government was going to be making this announcement in the evening. And that was the last time I set foot on campus for 6 months. But work, sort of, if anything, got heavier in that time, because I was having to retrain and do everything online, had to buy a new laptop, and then of course students were about to graduate and they were all panicking a bit, but whereas normally I'd say, come to the office and we'll have a chat about everything, it was like, oh, I'll have this conversation but on my phone, or and it did feel very strange, and we didn't know whether this was going to go on for a few weeks, a few months, or, you know, or whether this was going to be like the new way of things, and that, you know, the rest of our lives, and perhaps actually there have been some benefits, because we're now used to having online meetings, which can be useful in terms of meeting people who otherwise would have to take a train or a plane or a train and, you know, spend their whole day out of their normal comfort zone for a 2-hour meeting. If you've got a PhD Viva or something, you can do that online. So there are many pluses. But do you want to say a little bit about what you do? Because obviously you work in the School of English.
Yes, so I am a senior lecturer, that's the title, in 18th century studies. And I research and teach the literature, broadly speaking, of the 18th century period, Anglophone literature. So anything from sort of 1680 to 1820, very long 18th century. And I focus mostly on poetry and political pamphlets and ephemera in my research, which is really around masculinity, nationhood, and gender and sexuality in the literature of that period. And I published a book which is called Effeminate Years: Literature, Politics and Aesthetics in Mid-18th Century Britain, and it parses those issues. So I'm really interested in sexuality in the past, but also more recently disability in the past as well. So that's broadly speaking what my research is. But then I teach anything from, you know, literary theory to contemporary Irish writing. So I kind of teach broadly here in the School of English.
Yeah, I find it so fascinating in terms of making those connections between what may or may not have been either in the text or maybe behind the text, and, you know, I feel like Jane Austen or whatever. I remember doing Jane Austen at school, and it's really interesting how watching a film like The Greatest Showman, and I remember thinking, this is interesting because it's like applying contemporary equality, diversity, inclusivity issues around disability to the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And I thought that it kind of worked, because, you know, for the first part of that film I remember thinking, hang on, this is completely anachronistic, and it's like watching sort of like Britain's Got Talent, but, you know, in the 19th century, I thought they wouldn't have had technology that amazing. But then as I watched it, I also thought that it was a wonderful and very moving sort of conceit, because it's sort of saying that some of the things that now we're starting to deal with, I mean, you know, we're diversifying the curriculum, decolonising the curriculum. Mm. You know, I've been at Kent for 17 years, discovering that some of the things that I've just taken for granted turn out to be really quite parochial, you know, in terms of the composition of reading lists. It's like that they tend to be predominantly male and Western, and maybe there are other avenues to explore in terms of research on death and the afterlife, whatever it might be. But in your case, how did that journey start for you? So why the focus on that particular historical period? It just sounds fascinating.
Yeah, so I suppose it goes back a long way for me, and it originated the sort of the interest in the 18th century really, well, the furthest back is when I was a child and I was going to the sort of big houses of Carton and I can't think of the other name now. God, it's so long since I've been in Ireland, but I'm from a place called Maynooth, and there are houses, 18th century kind of neoclassical, stately houses, really kind of like pinning the town on either end, Carton is one, and Castletown is the other, which is kind of more closer to this other town called Selbridge. But I used to kind of go to these houses and be really interested in the wealth, which certainly wasn't where I was coming from as a child, but the sort of the splendour, obviously the degradation of it, the history of it, and thinking about what was here and who lived here and so on. So that was the kind of the first sort of entry point. And then really during my degree studying English literature and history, I was always interested in literature of the past and interested in that historical dimension, and also just sort of interested in what history was for, how we could write history, who got to write history, who did history serve, and what were the methods of doing so. And these interests sort of connected when I started to take courses on the kind of survey courses on the 18th century, much like the survey course that I teach, you know, here at Kent. A fantastic lecturer, Dr. Conrad Brunstrom, was teaching this 18th century survey course, and I got really sort of stuck in, I suppose, to the literature of the period. And he took various different approaches to teaching. So he was kind of thinking about all sorts of things when we were looking at a text, including gender and sexuality. And at that time, I mean, I had been out as gay for, since I was kind of 17. And I would be like 18, 19 at this time. But I was very interested in the history of gayness, I suppose. And it was through taking courses by Conrad Brunstrom at Maynooth. There was one particular course it was a specialist course on the 18th century, where, I was able to write an essay on sexuality in the period. And it was through reading like Michel Foucault, thinking about some of those arguments about the birth of the homosexual and so on. And that was a really sort of shocking, intellectually shocking moment for me to think, well, actually, there's a history to this kind of thing that I sometimes feel is intrinsic about me, sometimes feel ambivalent. I feel, judged for, I definitely feel codified in some sort of way, I feel different, and there's different sort of, it's going to sound very Foucauldian, but so arrangements of power around this particular position that I have taken, that I've come out as. And there's a history to those arrangements of power. And what would it mean if I were to trace that history? Which is, I think, every gay boy, a gay intellectual boy's fantasy when they hit Foucault and they think about, this possibility of tracing back these arrangements of power, which have material basis. It's not just, Foucault's very discursive, it's not just discursive, but thinking about what does it mean to think about the history of gayness, or the history of queerness, we might put it, and the history of transness, and so on. And that's really where I started. And the 18th century is very, and it remains very fertile ground for thinking about questions of gender and sexuality, because really it's that particular period of the Enlightenment, with all its capital E's and westernization, but it's that particular period that has bequeathed to us our modern regime of gender and sexuality, which is ongoing and in flux. So it was looking at the texts from that period, not so much to think about what's there or what's not there, but how do they codify gender and sexuality? What are the possibilities here for reading into the 18th century, but also allowing the 18th century to speak back to this question of masculinity, sexuality? What can that teach us? What can that help me to unravel about how
yeah, it is deeply personal, but also broader than that, how is this question being sort of formed now, today?
But that's the way into it, isn't it? Because, you know, there has to be a hook that makes us want to go ahead. You know, if you're going to devote time to reading novels and poetry, and if you're going to undertake research, that there's always a reason, you know, behind it. You know, whenever people say to me, and I know people who have done this, when it's sort of like, oh, it's just a bit random, or I knew I wanted to do a PhD, but didn't know what to do it in, so I just asked somebody, you know, where are the gaps, and I did that, and you're like, so you're now an expert in something that was utterly random, and I'm never comfortable with that answer. But what you were saying, when I was at university, I had a close friend who was gay, and she did a degree in English, but nobody knew that she was gay, and I think
I never had that problem.
Well, and it's interesting now looking back on her, because she's now a novelist and she writes lesbian fiction.
Yeah,
and I'm so pleased for her because when she was a student, you know, this was a taboo, and so I think she was fine. Who wrote Morris and the Remains and Howard's End? But the you know, Edwardian writer who, and she was sort of immersing herself in the literature of the past, knowing that it was perfectly acceptable to study that, but she was interested in the sort of questions that maybe with her family that weren't able to come up. So she was using the academic study as a springboard to answering some of those personal questions about identity. But what I found fascinating about that, because I haven't seen her in decades, but now that she is out and writing all this wonderful fiction, I sort of wonder to what extent all of that would have impacted on where she is now, because she had a very difficult ride, and it took decades for her to reach the point now where she can write freely and write the sort of literature that is right for her. But I'm so interested in going backwards and trying to sort of see, could you ever have imagined outside of your wildest, perhaps, imagination all those years ago, that you could ever have reached this point where it was okay to write on what you want to write about, and that's deeply personal, without feeling that this is crossing a line?
I think I came from a very different point where I was always very sure that I, you know, there was nothing wrong with me in terms of being gay. I mean, probably things wrong with me in other ways, but, you know, there was nothing wrong, or, you know, kind of, I never really sort of bought the moralistic kind of currents around sexuality. I think once it's consensual and so on. So I don't know what was with me when I was younger, but I never felt shamed. I felt terrified. I felt hurt. I felt angry, like lots of rage at people who would, whatever, harass me, but never shame. So I didn't come to the work in quite the same way as the. Although I can identify what you're saying about your friend. So I think I could. I think I could imagine a future. I could always imagine a future where I would be, you know, comfortable with myself or whatever. Could I imagine this particular future? No. I think, you know, getting to do that course with Dr. Conrad Brunstrom, getting to then go on and do, a master's, getting to go back to Maynooth to do a PhD with Dr. Conrad Brunstrom, and then getting a job at Kent literally within a few months of finishing my PhD, coming over here. And I mean, this has just been so transformative. I mean, I look back now, like thinking, having the occasion to do so for this podcast, and I'm thinking, gosh, I don't know if I'd recognize myself, or if myself then would fully recognize me. There would be, like, you know, certain contours, certain things that remain the same, but, you know, utterly transformed. So in that way, I don't think I could have imagined then this transformation, but I think I did imagine a future in which I was not shamed by my sexuality, because I wasn't really shamed then either. So
well, it's fascinating to see the change of contours. I had a conversation with my students a few years ago around the time that same-sex marriage was implemented. And the consensus, I mean, admittedly, this is just among my religious studies students who may not be representative of their generation, but the sense was, this is great, and what's the issue? And it was just fascinating for me to go back a few decades and to realise that the hurt and the shame and the feeling of disempowerment and the idea that families would have nothing to do with their offspring if they were gay. And that was only, because that was this particular friend, we went on holiday to Great Yarmouth in 1992. And I was there with my own children just 2 weeks ago. And of course, it brought it all back, that all the conversations that we had, where the facade was, that we were a couple, actually. And what was just amazing is that there were all those sort of issues around the way you present yourself to the world. And it was just being back in the same place. You know, I was sort of joking to myself, you know, which has moved on more, you know, in the last 30 years, Great Yarmouth or me, you know, which has changed more. But it brought it all back. And it was a very acute sense that this was... what 30 years ago was a real taboo for some people isn't now. And that actually is just so fascinating and bewildering also to look at, because you sort of think of all the angst and the stress and the conversations and the guilt and the anxiety. And I think that what's changed, very obviously changes, whereas then, you know, if even with students there was a perception, if two same-sex individuals were kissing in the student union bar, then the chances were somebody would come over and say, "Oh, we don't approve. You shouldn't do that." Now, if somebody came over and said that, the person who told them off would be subject to sort of disciplinary procedures, and that is a good thing. But I just think, you know, either I'm now very old, or, you know, I just think, you know, how did we go from that to where we are now?
Well, yeah, I suppose from my perspective, and I recognise all of that, and I hear what you're saying about that change, that huge change that can be marked by legislative change. So the introduction of same-sex marriage in 2013 in this country, and later on by popular vote in Ireland. You know, there have been these massive changes. I'm more cautious, though. And as I get older, I'm not that old. And by the way, you don't look old at all.
Yeah, I'm 48.
Yeah, so you don't look it, but so there you go. You know, as I get older, I'm less celebratory about those changes, and I'm less sure of the ground that has been won. And I think it has become a kind of a position that one takes, that isn't it great, you know, how far we've come. First of all, not everybody is part of that we, and not everybody is allowed to move the necessary paces on the chessboard, if you know what I mean. So I'm, you know, to the world, a gay, white, cisgendered man. I mean, I don't talk publicly about my gender, so I'm not going to say much about it. But, you know, my relationship to cis masculinity is a very strained one. You know, my relationship to gender itself is very complex. And, that's all I'll say about that. But I have, for all intents and purposes, a lot of privilege. I mean, I have a lot of privilege in terms of my job. I have a lot of privilege in terms of my whiteness. I have a lot of privilege in terms of my gayness, actually, because gay men are the white gay men are the sort of the ones that have it the easiest in that ever expanding, joyfully so, ever expanding acronym. I mean, what I see happening is I see, you know, LGBT people, but mostly T people, so transgender and non-binary people, really just getting it in the neck and no holds barred, absolutely no holds barred. So whilst someone won't maybe publicly be homophobic, they will be publicly transphobic, absolutely, and feel entitled to that transphobia, which is, you know, really heinous and really, really dark. It's become very dark in this country because the debate has been sort of drawn in these ways around feminism, which doesn't surprise me. And anyone who's studied feminism will know that, you know, feminism has always had this issue with, well, the category of woman and who does that, who belongs and who doesn't, and who does feminism speak for, or who does feminism speak to? I mean, if it's not a feminism that includes every woman, and trans women are women, then it's a deficient, problematic feminism that in many ways is being weaponized. So I think there's that debate going on, and that has sort of crept into queer LGBT spaces. It has rocked, you know, national organizations. It has really sort of taken up people's time and energy. And the people who are suffering are the trans women, trans men, and non-binary people who are really having to have those daily decisions of, like, am I going to go and use that bathroom and survive? Do you know? Am I going to be able to go and go into that bar, or go into, you know, walk down that street? Do I pass? Do, you know, it's gender is such a kind of complex issue. I had thought we had, and this is my own academic bubble, I had thought that we'd moved beyond a point where we were kind of really hammering in essentialism. Like, you're either one, you know, you're a man or you're a woman and that's it. I mean, I thought we had kind of looked at that binary and kind of thought, well, it's more complex, you know, and there's going to be nuances, and there's going to be, you know, people who really are, you know, sure that they are, you know, this way or that way, and people who aren't, and that's fine. And I felt there was a kind of permissiveness there. And, you know, a couple of years ago, I took my head up out of my whatever queer theory books I was reading, and I was like, no, actually, there is a problem here, because people are being really impacted by very toxic notions of gender, and very sort of restrictive and, I would say, sort of, you know, kind of puritanical notions about what gender is, or who gets to inhabit particular genders. And I really thought that it's a backlash. I mean, that's what it is. It's an absolute backlash. But it's a backlash that is having a real effect on trans people and their families, their communities. I mean, trans people are everywhere. There are students, there are partners, there are NHS worker, you know, it's just, but in the media and in how this is becoming portrayed, it's almost like trans people are this group of people that, like, live in a colony, yeah, and they're being annihilated. So I think in terms of things have moved on, things have moved on, but not everyone has been brought along. Not everyone has been allowed to say, okay, come on, you're coming with us. You know, you're part of us. And, you know, if they're going to, you know, beat me up for kissing a guy, I'm not going to let them beat you up for, you know, wearing what you want to wear. And that is not happening. I mean, yes, there's plenty of gay men who support trans rights. But in terms of what's happening, I see splintering and kind of sort of fractious
sort of debate often happening, and that, yeah, that really saddens me.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right, because I think the Green Party, there was, I don't know the details, and it's interesting that it wasn't reported, but there was a fallout between the two co-leaders of the Green Party, I think, over the question of trans rights, and that just made me think, gosh, you know, this is something that there may be some forms of equality which are now taken for granted. But the idea that somehow legislation is going to suddenly, you know, with a sweep of a brush, just suddenly going to make sure that, you know, everybody now has the right to live as they choose, you're always going to come across prejudice. And I think, actually, you summed it up perfectly when you said that there's this perception that some people are going to be sort of like, there's an otherness about them, that they don't mix in the same circles. A good example, not specifically to do with trans, but it was when, you know, in the days when a cabinet minister would resign because of their sexuality. I mean, it's laughable now that you know, somebody's sexuality would have a bearing on whether they were good to be Secretary of State for Wales, whatever it might be. But I remember being in a pub in West Wales when Ron Davies, who was the Welsh Secretary, and there was something in the news about, well, it didn't come out at first, but there was cottaging, and in one of the parks in London. And he resigned, but there was more to the story than that. But it took a while for us to sort of know everything that happened. I just remember being in this pub in West Wales, and this local farmer who was very derogatory. I won't repeat what he said, but effectively it was, you know, we don't want somebody of that disposition. He didn't put it quite that eloquently in, you know, running the country. And I thought, that is so obviously insensitive and despicable, but this sort of perception that somehow if people are going to do quote normal jobs, that therefore it has to be part and parcel with a particular sexual orientation, and that is breathtakingly absurd.
Yeah.
But not at the time, because that was the norm. You know, cabinet ministers, if they were found to be gay, would, I think of Matthew Paris, the Tory MP, who effectively, when he was outed, you know, he didn't stay a Conservative MP for much longer. And that was only, what, 35, 40 years ago?
Well, the shadow of Section 28 is, I mean, it looms large. I mean, and particularly in Kent, where when it was, you know, gotten rid of in England, Kent County Council voted to keep a version of it, you know, and I teach in Kent, so I mean, teaching, you know, queer studies along with 18th century studies at the University of Kent has always had that kind of particular cachet. And I mean, I know gay men in this city and around this county who are very scarred. It's obvious to me they're very scarred from growing up here. And growing up under something like Section 28 or Section 28 revised, as it was. So, yeah, I mean, that is absolutely still in the ether of this place.
And I find it really interesting that, you know, we started by looking at lockdown, and you may remember that I think it was on the Radio 4, the PM programme, that they were inviting people to write in with their lockdown diaries. And I thought, well, what about what people were doing before lockdown? And analogous to what we're talking about here, what I find interesting is that people who are now in a very different place to where they might have been 20 or 30 years ago, but to use the diaries or the accounts or the letters or simply to try and recall the conversations from that period. I guess to an extent that's partly what, you know, one of the things that I am doing with this podcast. But in terms of, you know, I find it so interesting is the journey. So I'm, in the case of my friend who wrote the lesbian novel, and it's an amazing work, but to read it in the context of what she couldn't have been allowed to write, or she herself would never have written 20, 30 years ago, I'm so interested in that sort of, you know, because I keep a diary, but to go back on all my time spent with her and the conversations we had, and just to sort of, and what's remarkable is often the journey rather than the destination. And I think that what you've picked up on is that the destination is always going to be
unfulfilled. A bit like The Shawshank Redemption, which ends on the beach, and it shouldn't end on the beach. It should end on the bus there. The journey to the to Zihuatanejo, rather than Zihuatanejo itself. Because, as in life, you know, I suppose there's one ultimate destination, there's a final destination for all of us, but there are lots of mini destinations along the way. Like a student, you do your degree, and when you've got your degree, which has been your goal for the last 3 or 4 years, once you've got it, you move to the next stage, and there's always going to be, and there's always this commingling as well, because, you know, you're looking to your next career, or the next, or maybe postgraduate study, before you finished your first degree. But in terms of everything we're talking here about sexuality, for example, it's interesting that you can't let go sometimes of some of those antecedents. And I think what you're doing with literature is just brilliant, because you're able to look through a different sort of lens. We all look at everything that we do through the lens of now, but looking at something that at the time that it was written perhaps would have had a very different public profile.
Well, it's just so interesting to hear you speak about the Shawshank Redemption and where it should have ended. And what I'm picking up on in what you're saying there is kind of this idea of queer as a kind of arrow in motion and a kind of a moving target. And you know, to theorize queer is to think about how queer is in flux, in process, can't be pinned down, kind of. I mean, queer is an identity for people and they gain meaning from it, but the kind of queer that I think of is a kind of set, unlimited set of possibilities, a kind of critique of identity in some way, a kind of a tool. So what I'm picking up on what you're saying there about things kind of moving and it sounds very queer to me, actually, what you're saying. I'm getting a bit excited by that, but yeah.
Well, I would apply it to everything, though. I mean, for me, I mean, this is a very perhaps odd example, but I remember people would say to me sometimes, family members, "But you've seen that film before. Why do you want to watch it again?" And I'm like, "Well, that's like saying to somebody who likes the Beatles, you know, if you like the Beatles, you're not going to say, 'Oh, I listened to the Beatles in the 60s. Oh, it's my favourite music.' But you're not going to listen to it again because you've already heard it. If something impacts on you, you're going to watch it and rewatch it in different formats. And that is the exciting bit for me. So I, as you know, I go to the cinema an awful lot. But there are always, and also it's the role of the audience. I saw Jojo Rabbit and I saw it in Dover with a lot of younger men around me who were laughing at all the anti-Semitic jokes. And I despised the film because what I was listening to, I thought it was sort of encouraging an atmosphere of intolerance. And then the film got all these awards and it was nominated in the Oscars. And I thought, well, that wasn't my experience of this. And a few people said to me, "Go and watch it again," because they had I wrote my review of it and I was castigating it. But then I saw it again at the Curzon Cinema in Canterbury, and a very different clientele, actually a colleague from work, actually happy because his family, they turned up and sat next to me. And I found the film intensely moving. So I think that's what I'm getting at, the idea that everything is fixed. I used to think that, perhaps. I used to think that, you know, if you're reading a particular figure or theorist, then, you know, that this is what they stood for. Like quibbing for an exam, you know, 1, 2, 3, these are their values. But now, of course, you look at it and say, but we can only look at that through the lens of wherever we're coming from at a particular moment in time.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And when you said Jojo Rabbit, I thought you were talking about some kind of cartoon, but actually it's that I now remember the film.
The Holocaust.
I didn't actually catch it. But you know, that sounds right. It's the possibility of different moments, different iterations, and, you know, re-encountering literature and film and art that you may have read or experienced is often an opportunity to, you know, re-encounter yourself.
And in terms of we started on music there for just a moment, but in terms of growing up, this is the question I always ask in the interviews. I mean, I'm somebody who was of an age where the top 40 charts on a Sunday, in the day before the internet, when, you know, I used to write down the charts every Sunday. These days, it's like, well, you just go online. Why would you want to do that? Why would you wait all the time with different colours if it's going up the charts, down the charts? But that was the talk in the playground on the Monday morning, where our favourite records were. They were records in those days, in relation to our personal tastes. But did music play an important role when you were growing up?
It did, and it took me a very long time to get into a particular genre or style. I had older brothers and sisters, but I actually can't remember, did they ever share music with me? Or, you know, sometimes that's where you get it. I don't think I did. I think I was picking up on influences. Like, I remember, this is a very clear memory for me, of watching breakfast television. When breakfast television was a thing, it was only like maybe 6 or 7 or whatever, and I'd go down and I'd get my cornflakes and I'd sit in front of the TV and no one would be up. And I remember the Spice Girls being introduced on, I can't remember the show, but it was that breakfast show. And yeah, that's my little memory of like of pop cultural history, that it was their first kind of interview. And growing up then, I was kind of very aware that if you liked a particular band or whatever, then people would be able to sort of judge you on that, you know, like as teenagers. So I remember some male friends actually liked the Spice Girls, but I was always very kind of cautious about maybe I just didn't really even like them. But I didn't really kind of reveal that. The first record I bought was a Marilyn Manson single called Disposable Teens. And I used to kind of get lots of magazines about heavy metal music. And I think I was attracted to it because the men were more sort of androgynous. Mm. And the boys at school that really liked heavy metal and indie rock were always really chill and cool and not kind of hung up. They wouldn't come in the morning and sort of, you know, call me gay immediately. You know, they wouldn't, you know, they'd kind of like just be kind of more chilled. So I think that's why I gravitated towards that music, even though I didn't actually really like Marilyn Manson or whatever. And then I got into kind of like Placebo, who I did really like. Really into, yeah, Placebo, I think, were the first band that I really kind of got into. And then I started to go back. I found out about The Cure and The Smiths. And I would just listen to albums, like just go through albums, listening to them. And actually, it's funny because ending up in England wasn't such of a shock because I was trained to expect what England would be like because of Morrissey singing about, you know, closed down seaside towns and, you know, every day is like Sunday and, you know, the Queen is dead. And so I kind of, you know, in some ways, even now, that kind of musical, you know, experience trained me. And then even Morrissey turning out to be a massive racist, I mean, that's that was like, you know, that, you know, obviously don't listen to anything he produces now, but that has also been a kind of, you know, kind of a coming full circle.
That's one of those crises of faith, isn't it, when, you know, I mean, for me, radio has always been and is one of my big, I mean, for film is of what people associate me with, but growing up with radio, that was my primary love. You know, if my dream job would be to do a radio show, I suppose, through the podcast, in the way I am. But those people who influenced me, and those broadcasters I used to listen to, in later years, I would then discover that some of them were quite, maybe, right-wing. They were conservative supporters. Yeah. You know, and there was some, you know, maybe 20-odd years ago, they'd have all this sort of, you know, these are all the celebrities. There was, like, Cilla Black and Patrick Moore, and then Ed Stewart. And I was like, oh, right, so these are the people who, you know, I enjoy listening to, and they're people who I grew up with in many cases, but they represent particular, you know, political dispositions that I don't hold, and that is interesting, and I don't know how to square that circle sometimes because something doesn't entirely fit because, you know, my outlook is very different, and yet I might be gravitating to somebody whose
way of looking at the world is one that I really don't agree with. So if I met them, would I be terribly disappointed? Would that, would the illusion be shattered?
No, hang on. Let's just go back a minute. You're telling me Cilla Black is a Tory?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. She said...
Oh, my God.
Obviously, before I put this out, she apparently once said that Margaret Thatcher put the great into Great Britain.
Oh, my God. I can't believe that.
Yeah.
Well, it's a difficult one. I think with Morrissey, he's just... He's dirtied his bib. I mean, like, I can't... I mean, the whole thing with cancel culture is... you know, I think it's I mean, it came from kind of adolescent black male culture and online culture, and it, you know, it could be quite a powerful thing. I think now, like so many of these things, it has become a part of this culture war, and you know, people who are supposedly cancelled, if only they actually were cancelled, because these cancelled people, my God, you see them, you hear them, they're on every show talking about how they don't have any space to talk, or how they're cancelled, or how the left have, you know, kind of done this to them. And, you know, I can only think of a handful of examples of people who have actually been cancelled, and that's been after a lot of, you know, decisions that those people have made that have revealed them to be, you know, racists or whatever it is. So it's really down to them. It's not down to any particular, you know, body of people, you know, sitting around, you know, deciding, you know, electing who gets to be cancelled. It's just because those people are saying things and doing things that are, you know, heinous, really. Mm. But sadly, people who get cancelled, I mean, not a lot of people actually get cancelled.
I remember finding that, you know, 20, 30 years ago, you'd have all these sort of people who were like the faces of TV, even, you know, primetime Saturday entertainment. Jim Davidson was an example. Mm. Now, Jim Davidson is somebody who seems to be very happy to rock the boat. In fact, he sort of seems to get off on it. That, you know, he doesn't get any TV work anymore, and it's not surprising.
Mm.
But you'd think he could just play the game and just like, okay, well, I'll, you know, because presumably those, you know, there are race... He certainly will say a racist joke. I'm not going to say he's racist. He will say racist things.
Mm.
And you'd think that he would... You know, he didn't do that when he was doing The Big Break or The Generation game on TV. So you'd think that he would just sort of like, you know, hold back. But he's gone the opposite way. And actually, he was performing not far from here in Margate a few years ago. And I went to see him. What I wanted to do was think, you know, to see, is this all a facade? Yeah, because I grew up with this guy on TV, and I, but the Jim Davidson that's now been exposed, I don't like.
Mm.
So therefore, I want to just see, is it just a game that he's playing? Is he just sort of that's his, that's his persona? And I didn't quite know what to make of it, because in a way, yeah, he was very funny, but he was saying things that were whipping up the audience in a way that, because they were all like-minded, and at one point he had a real go at Guardian reading university types, and I was put about four rows from the front, and I thought, I really shouldn't be here. And you know, I thought, I do not fit in. I looked around, they were, you know, male and female there, but they were all white. And whenever he was talking about the problems with PC, you know, everyone was agreeing and clapping.
Mm.
And there was lots of stuff about support for the military and so on. And I left. I'm so glad I went. But also what I thought was, this is somebody who really, maybe, I suppose, there's a sense of authenticity there. And, you know, at least he's not pretending to be somebody that he isn't. But, you know, I really find that then has a bearing on how I look back and the things I would sit and watch him on TV when I was growing up. And now just think, you know, and what that does to your older self, when the things that you take for granted, things that you like and the things that you identify with, are now things that actually you have to revisit. And that's life. I mean, that's not just being an academic, the pleasure that we have sometimes in being able to revisit and reframe all of those things. But have you had similar kind of experiences there? I think with Morrissey, that's a very good example.
Yeah, I called Morrissey racist, and that is my view, and that's a lot of people's view of him based on his actions and things that he has has said. And yeah, I mean, I wouldn't go to his concert. I wouldn't buy any of his.
Would you listen back to some of the music from that you bought in the
Smiths? Yeah, I have. I mean, I have listened to songs from the Smiths, and yeah, I have.
But also, of course, there's a lot of you in there, in the and growing up in Ireland or wherever, because listening to that, it's not just Morrissey and Morrissey's views now. That is the soundtrack to your childhood, and that for me is the problem. Whoever stuff comes, I digitized all my old like music tapes years ago, and some stuff will come on like Rolf Harris or something, and it's like, oh, this is, and it's awful because that is so interwoven with my childhood. Mm. You know, what do you switch it off? You press fast forward, or do you just tolerate it? If I'm on my own in the car, well, maybe I can do that. If somebody was with me, I would not expose that. Because there's a sense of embarrassment, but also just a respect to the fact that, you know, this is somebody who seemed a bit eccentric a few decades ago, and now we learn that eccentricity was you know, not the greatest crime he perpetrated. And I think that it disrupts all of our sort of identities when the comfort sometimes of childhood or the way we, you know, whether, I mean, we're talking about nostalgia, whether we look back at the past through a rose-coloured lens, it's what happens when those things that seemed cosy and nice and funny, and maybe you remember listening to the music or watch those programs with your family around you, maybe those family members are not there anymore. Mm. So there's, you don't want to let go of all of that, but at the same time, you also feel that this is something where you have to take a stand because you're not the same person, and whether those celebrities were the same people that they were then is in a way not the point, because you didn't know, but you know now what you didn't know then, and you have to react accordingly.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a difficult kind of set of considerations to work through, but I think the main thing for me is, you know, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. So, you know, I think calling out somebody as racist, I mean, we're so afraid to call someone out or to, you know, to, we often excuse as well. And I think there's actually more harm done in kind of skirting around, or, you know, kind of, you know, maybe it was a different time, or, you know, so I'm always fascinated by these kind of the ways in which we sort of make the racist disappear.
Yeah.
Like, it was racist in terms of the commentary, but the part, or as you were talking about that, and there's no criticism of you, but as you were talking about that presenter, I forget their name, that you were wondering, was it just an act? And I don't really distinguish between somebody being racist for an act and being actually racist. I'm less interested in whether they're doing it because they fully subscribe to this view, or they're doing it as a kind of pose. The damage is done.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's there. It's in the world. There's an audience laughing. You know, there's a kind of a brutality and grotesqueness accepted, and that will have ramifications on people of color and so on. And, you know, again, you know, I'm white, so this doesn't affect me, but if I don't speak out about it, you know, and we all don't do that, then it will continue to have those ramifications. So I'm not so much interested in the distinction between, like, is someone posing or is, because, you know, there are, that's something also that comes up in kind of, you know, they're just doing it for attention, or it's kind of become fashionable to be racist, in chat shows, and this idea of balance, and, you know, that we sort of get anyway. So that's one thing. So I'm kind of fascinated as to the ways in which we sort of explain racism away. But in terms of this podcast and nostalgia, I was thinking about this on the bus, and I was thinking, actually, the culture wars and the kind of things that we've been discussing about, you know, toxic online culture and so on, so much of it is about nostalgia. And this sense of something that's been lost and that needs to be regained. And there's all these annoying, you know, minorities in the way of how it used to be. I mean, I was just... I haven't been on Facebook in years, and I used to be on Twitter, and well, it's a short story. Somebody was really horrible about my disability. I'm visually impaired. I have a kind of a degenerative eye condition, and I used to talk about it quite a lot on there to raise awareness and so on. And somebody from the LGBT community was absolutely horrible about something I'd said about my condition. They even went, and it wasn't just one tweet, they went to the, you know, making a meme about blindness, and it was just, so I left. So I'm not on Twitter anymore, and I do miss it, but I just, it was just too much really for me to kind of to bear really. So good on them anyway. But I had a couple of months where I was on no social media whatsoever. And then I reactivated Facebook because I had basically turned that off. And I was really worried because I found myself getting into arguments with people on Facebook about their views and about their often, you know, close family, but extended family or relatives or people you worked at and you don't really... maybe you worked a part-time job with one time and they were on your Facebook. Mm. And I was seeing it coming up with these kind of things, and I'd feel like I'd have to go in and, you know, comment and defend whatever, gay people or people of colour or whatever. And I left, but I reactivated it, and I decided to get loads of people off it, so defriend a lot of people, and then also just kind of use it like a kind of... I joined all these groups, you know, for like Star Trek and, you know, these kind of little fan groups, and I go in and I kind of look at them every day, and there's stuff about, you know, the disability groups and stuff about eye conditions and so on. And anyway, in joining these groups, I joined this group about my hometown, and the, you know, I didn't always have a great time there. Anyway, fine, whatever, I've moved on, and I go back and I visit, and I have not so good memories and I have fond memories, and I don't know who these people are. They're a lot older than me, but they post these pictures and so on. And there's this one picture that was posted of the Royal Canal, which is a canal that goes through the centre of Maynooth. I might as well just say it, Maynooth. And this harbour has been like radically changed over the last, you know, 20 years. There's like a new playground, there's nice benches, there's a... In this picture from the 80s, there wasn't even a stone path. It was this kind of like mud, right? This mud and a kind of rickety old bridge, and it just looked like a swamp. And the comment underneath was from this person who said, those were the days... those were the, you know, that's when Maynooth was really lovely, or whatever, some version of that. And no disrespect to that person who, in a weird way, could end up listening to this podcast, as it is going to be on Facebook. But I just thought to myself, what is happening here that, you know, you could literally produce any picture of Maynooth from the 70s or the 80s. You could show the most... Banjak's, you know, public area, decrepit, that, you know, objectively has been considerably improved and is a much nicer place in 2021. And someone would comment along the lines of, oh, that's when it was really good, or it's not like that now, we'll never get that back. And I just think nostalgia is dangerous. Mm. It's really dangerous because... to me, like, if that was to... what, I don't know what the desire that is actually speaking to, but if that woman had a magic wand and she could just make the Harbour Arm back into the shithole, quite frankly, that it was, you know, kids won't have a playground, people won't have, you know, the nice wide paths where they can run, You know, the lighting where it's safer to do so in the evening and so on. Yeah. The kind of, you know, all this kind of stuff. So how do you satisfy her desire? What is her desire speaking to?
Yeah.
How much of that desire fuels the kind of misinformed hatred towards all of these so-called minorities or whatever, who there's this perception now have disproportionately a place in society or a voice or, you know, what did someone say the other day? A vote, like gay people get 2 votes or something. I don't know. And, you know, it's that same sort of sense of nostalgia that is about putting people back in their box, putting people back in the shit, basically. Yeah. And I think it comes from a sense of loss that people have, a personal loss, but also a kind of uncriticality that is really dangerous. And I think the culture wars, if anything, are about nostalgia.
Yeah.
And if anything, reveal the dangers of the nostalgic mode.
Yeah. And no, you're absolutely right on that, because well, Brexit obviously exposed that, because it made a binary out of something. You know, just as we think we're becoming more enlightened, or we're sort of moving in the direction, a more positive direction, and, you know, we have a more sort of, you know, even the Tory government under David Cameron seemed more sort of liberal in its sort of ethos than previous Conservative administrations. Then Brexit comes along and completely tears the country, you know, in two. But the question of nostalgia is interesting, because you mentioned this you know, harbour, this horrible, you know, period of the town's past, which is somebody's putting on a pedestal. See, this is interesting, because I think because I've always kept a diary, the diary is always a corrective against the attempt to say, oh, it was good in those days, because I might be guilty of saying that. Oh, the 90, you know, there are particular years in my life, like 1992, I thought, oh, that was a good year. But if I look at my diary from 92, I was obviously anxious about exams and my future. I was at university around that time. And, you know, so, and there were wonderful things from that period, but the idea that it was blessed and perfect and prelapsarian, of course, is not borne out by reality. So I think a critical reflexivity is essential. So in many cases, doing the podcast has been wonderful, because some of the people I've caught up with are people who I knew from 30 years ago. And we've just carried on, you know, our conversations have just picked up from where we left off 30 years ago. So there are so many things about the way we engage with the past, which is actually really efficacious. However, the danger, I think, is if somebody then imagines that the way things as they saw it back then, which may or may not have accorded with the actuality, is then a benchmark for the way things should be now. And Brexit, I'm afraid, and actually I started doing this podcast not when we were still in the midst of all the Brexit turmoil. I remember Vince Cable, when he was leader of the Lib Dems, said Brexit really was all about nostalgia.
Yeah.
Or a nostalgia that maybe never existed. And,
yeah.
And maybe that's something we can turn to, because as we start to wrap up, one of the questions I always ask at this point is whether one's memories are predominantly positive, or whether you can be nostalgic about negative experiences.
This always sort of throws me, because I know people who really live in their past and are very nostalgic for like their school days or, you know, growing up with their sibling. They, you know, if you meet them together, they'll be talking about, oh, do you remember when this happened and that happened and so on. I think I've always been very future orientated and looking towards the future. And my memories of the past are kind of the ones that come to mind, the clearest ones, are kind of like those Wordsworthian snapshots in time, if that doesn't sound. So Wordsworth had this sort of pattern in his poetry where he would kind of give us these sort of snapshots of time, kind of like epiphanies, really. But I do remember one such kind of moment. It's kind of my earliest moment. And I remember when it happened, because it was my birthday. And I remember thinking, I am now 4. And I remember going into my neighbour's house, and there was a massive wooden fence, and it's actually just like a kind of a waist height wooden fence really now, and it was closed, but to me it was massive. And I remember climbing over that wooden fence, and as I got over, one leg over very carefully, thinking, this is what it feels like to be 4. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it felt so clear and so pure and so real, actually, and almost as if I had defined something for myself, by myself, that I could kind of hang my hat on. And I got over that fence, and when I got over that fence, I was different. And that's a memory that... And there was a kind of more... And I knew I shouldn't have been on the fence. I would have gotten shouted at, and it was a trespassing. It was it was kind of this liminal... that word that we humanities people like to use. This sort of liminal sort of moment. But in that, I kind of recuperated something from the kind of chaos of being 4 and climbing a fence by myself without anyone there, without my big brother, without my big sister, without my mother, and kind of going into this back garden not knowing if my friend was there or if his family were there, and kind of just having that sort of independence. So sometimes in moments of real kind of discombobulation, for some reason, that memory comes back to me about climbing that fence and saying, this is what it feels like to be 4.
It's interesting what circumscribes us, because when you're 4, you're defined by adults, by your teachers at school, or maybe nursery teachers, because obviously, you know, you go to school at 4, but or parents or older siblings or whatever it might be. And you just made me think of something, because I remember walking down, because I'm from Cardiff originally, and I remember walking down the streets of Cardiff. And it was 1996, and I think actually, and of course, this may be a distorted memory, but I saw two films at the cinema. One of them was the adaptation of Emma with Gwyneth Paltrow.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think the other film I saw was A Time to Kill. And this is, so I was 23, and I was doing my PhD. I was walking down Cardiff on a Saturday afternoon, and whereas a few years earlier, I was very conscious of this, a few years earlier, I'd be walking down thinking, I'm a child, and everyone else around me is older, you know. Then I was walking down the street, and there were lots of younger people out, and you know, so on, it was a Saturday afternoon. I suddenly thought, I feel really old, you know, compared to the people. I was only 23, now I'm more than double that age. But there's a point where, like, I came to Kent in 2004, so I've been here 17 years. Now, then I was the youngest person, or one of the youngest people in my department. Now, and other colleagues, in many cases, were 3 decades older than me. They were in their 60s, I was in my 30s. But now, I'm approaching the age that the people who taught me when I was an undergraduate were, you know, so I'm not far off 50. Mm. And the people, and my parents are sort of, so I'm older now than my parents were when I went to university. And that has a real impact on you, because, you know, the students that I'll be teaching in a few weeks' time when we begin our term were born in 2003. Mm. So they were 1 when I started working here. And so liminal, I think, is a really good word, because there's that sense that we kind of feel that there's always this sense of flux. Mm. And that when you were younger, you got very vivid memories of being 4, but the world that you were inhabiting the age of 4 and the boundaries that you're allowed to trespass, you know, literally in the case of the fence you were talking about, are going to be very different to what now as an adult, as an educator, as a tutor, where you're displaying leadership rather than, you know, sort of worried about what the parent or the farmer or whatever it might be who owns the gate will tell you what for doing. And I think sometimes, and it may not all be nostalgia, maybe nostalgia is the wrong word for it, but that sense of awareness of coming from a certain point and heading somewhere, hopefully in a sort of a positive upward sort of direction, I think is something that we're aware of, whether we articulate it or not, because it didn't. That's obviously something that is a recurring memory for you.
Mm. Yeah, no, it is. Yeah,
And actually, just a couple more questions, because one of them actually you touched on this yourself, is as to whether you're in touch with friends from your past.
I don't know if I'm the best person that, you know, keeps in touch with people or has, like, the friend I sat at school with, you know. I'm not, no,
That, you know, that sounds bad, but I think I have had really, really strong friendships that no matter whether I still speak to the person, you know, or not, have informed me and continue to kind of shape my view on, you know, the world, and in some way friendships that still sustain me. But no, I don't have really, not that I can think of, really kind of long-term friends. I have friends from my PhD. I have some friends from my undergraduate. Friends from school? No. Friends from primary school? No. No. Just don't. Because of the kind of way I survived, I suppose, growing up, and being, you know, true to myself. It would have meant a lot of sacrifice for me to have those friends now and to keep those friends in my life. It would have meant a lot of me sort of denying things about myself and not being authentic.
Because I can remember, because I was a bit of an awkward child, really. You know, they were often, you know, I mean, I was often the target of, you know, bullies. You know, I was often very, often, because I was very skinny, and, you know, and that's a horrible thing to, you know, to do. But I just, I have some scars from that period. But I'm on a Facebook page, which is made up of people who went to the same school as me, the same secondary school. And actually, I've managed to develop a few, you know, friendships, or re-establish some friendships from that period, and done some interviews, or hope to do some interviews with people. But I also think of those people who are not directly in contact with me, and the people who, maybe the bullies themselves, and I know there are some of them there, I recognise some of the names. I wonder what they think of when they see me now after all these years. I mean, maybe they've completely forgotten me, but I often wonder, what do the people who make your life hell, what do they, because we remember the bullies, but they, those bullies themselves may have children of their own. Do they change, or are they still the same horrible, like the film It, you know, the horror film, which I think completely encapsulated that period of what it was like to be a teenager, or, you know, 1989 or whatever. But those are the people, like, I don't think I'd ever be interviewing them. But I do wonder what those people, whether their perceptions of time, whether they're aware of, they feel any guilt, maybe, for what they did, or maybe it's just, you know, water off a duck's back.
I don't think I remember any bullies, really, which is odd. I don't think I keep things that aren't useful. I think that's part of what I'm kind of focused on the future. And I think when I was in school, I came out very early. You know, someone said, "Oh, you're gay," and I said, "Yeah, so what?" Or you know, and, you know, like, and, you know, I think that was enough. I think what it was at that time, I was too out there. I was someone who was like, I don't care if you know I'm gay, you know, I didn't fit in anywhere. And I think I just sort of was like, I accepted that, and I accepted that I wasn't going to, you know, go to, you know, the debutante ball. I wasn't going to really partake in any sports. I wasn't going to, I was just going to kind of find what I could and get out, you know, just get out. And that's what I did. And, you know, I can't really remember. I remember some people giving me a punch and pushing me, or I'd always be, you know, trying to be tripped up. But there'd be times I'd turn around and I'd bash them into a wall. Like, I wasn't, you know, I had a short fuse as well. So, you know, gradually throughout school, I found that it was the younger kids that would try to pick on me. But people in my own
my own year, eventually as they kind of grew up as well, kind of didn't really, you know, didn't really kind of bully me anymore. And then, of course, some of them have come out since, yeah. You know, and I always knew. But, you know, it was what it was. I think it would be very different now. I think it would be very different for me now. But I, as I say, going back to what I said before, I really worry about that trans kid, you know,
yeah.
Because it's going to be all kinds of hell for them, given the society that you know that we live in, and the kind of way in which trans has become this kind of culture war flashpoint that's just, you know, really diminishing of that experience and just completely phobic and really about working out all sorts of things that, you know, have nothing to do with the real life trans person, yeah. You know, who is trans and who is so much more, you know. So yeah, I don't know, I kind of just resist that kind of you know, thinking about those sort of incidents. I sort of survived. I used to shock people. I used to like paint my nails. I used to like wear kind of really outrageous clothes. I used to just you know, anyway, yeah. I kind of played with it as well, and I probably brought a lot of it on myself in a way, because I was like, honest to God, like, if you're going to get worked up over, you know, me having a particular haircut, you know, or whatever, then here's the haircut, and yeah. You know.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think when people are very, I mean, one of my worst fears is, you know, that I suppose, you know, nobody. It's not that I have a problem with people, say, talking about me, but I don't, you know, I'm very happy to tell my story my own way.
Mm.
So, you know, if you sort of know that people are gossiping about you or whispering things about you, you sort of say, well, you know, I'll happily engage with you. I'm not going to be secretive.
Mm.
You know, I'm very open on Facebook about, you know, the things I do, the places I go. I like to sort of expose myself, put myself in places and kind of be very open about that.
Mm.
I didn't always used to be like that. I always used to always feel very, you know, concerned about what people might think about what I'm doing, especially when you're young. When I entered this profession, I was always wearing a tie because I thought people might think I'm a student, because, you know, I was, you know, not much older than the students I was teaching. Whereas now I've sort of gone the other way completely. And it's just interesting to sort of to chart that course. But in your case, it sounds as though you, rather than be somebody who was going to be intimidated by or threatened by or scared of what somebody might disclose or reveal or claim about you. You're like, but this is who I am. And therefore it's like, oh, then that's it. You know, it's like there's, you know, there's no, if you're very open about who you are and what you do, then people can't, as it were, do a dirty on you, because you've already beaten them to it, as it were, but on your own terms and in your own voice.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I mean, I suppose I was kind of driven to it in a way, to take that position, probably before I even really understood what it meant for me. But I think I was bullied about lots of things. I mean, I was bullied about being fat. I was bullied about being ginger. I was bullied because I came from a, scare quotes, broken home. I was bullied because I was poor. I was bullied because my older brother, you know, didn't like someone. Or you know what I mean? I was bullied for lots of things. Mm. And I just sort of think that, you know, within all of that, I still managed to kind of just, you know, pick myself up, do what I had to do. I didn't have an amazing time at school. But, you know, that was my sort of my experience. I had, you know, some really nice people, really good teachers. I knew that the world was a better place, and I knew that the world could be a better place for me. And I never lost sight of that. And I think that's what sustained me. But I think I'm also conscious that I'm speaking after having years and years of psychoanalysis and, you know, and kind of deep psychoanalysis. So this is a kind of view that maybe, you know, if you were to catch Declan, you know, 16-year-old, 14-year-old, 15-year-old, whatever, Declan, he might be
raging at me for being so kind of, you know, comfortable with that suffering. But I think one thing I have realized from school, and you get this in all sorts of environments, workplace environments, I mean, so much of that behavior carries over. People will misrepresent you. And I'm okay with that, because there's so many times that I have, you know, met people and spent time with them, and they've kind of turned around and said, "Wow, you're so nice," or you know, "I'm really sorry, I had this different view of you," and I won't get into, you know, where that came from, or whatever. But you know, I'm used to that, so I kind of just think, you know, people will misrepresent people because people feel that they can, you know, gain something often from that, or whatever, social capital or entry to whatever, I don't know. But, you know, as I grow older, becoming comfortable with that has been really sort of liberating. Mm. So people will have a view, they can say what they like about me, but, you know, I know what I stand for, I know what I'm about. It's taken a while to kind of, you know, to really settle into that. And one thing I try to do is kind of not put any of that out there, and just sort of take people at face value, and see where that, you know, where that leads. And to be kind of open as well to listening to others and listening to their perspective and what informs that. I become very curious about people who are quite different to me as well. So yeah, I think that's a huge change from the past. So I think maybe that's where it comes from.
Yeah.
You know, years of therapy and just sort of thinking, well, you know, people are going to misrepresent you no matter what you do. You can be the, you know, the best person, you can be the best, I don't know, partner, you can be the best teacher, you can be the best friend, you can be the best son, you can be the best whatever. And people are still going to, at some point, misrepresent what it is that, you know, Chris or Declan is about. And you know what? If people want to talk about me, that's fine. People have always talked about me. People will always talk about me. I'm so interesting. You know, how could they not talk about me? I'm not talking about them.
So
there you go. That says all.
And my very last question, Declan, which I think you've already answered. Are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Forward, absolutely forward, forward looking. Yeah, almost have to kind of center myself in the present, because I just think there's more to come. There's always more to come, and I'm always curious about how a story, and you know, we're all in stories, we're all in narratives. You know, some narratives more interesting, more dynamic, and more crucial than others at different points. But within that narrative, like a good book, I always want to get to the next page. I always want to see how things are going to end, for better or for worse. What's going to happen?
Yeah. And on that very upbeat note, Declan, it's been brilliant to have you as my guest this week.
Well, thank you so much. This has been fun. Thank you very much.